Tomorrow night at the Maryland Institute College of Art, fans of Morning Edition will get a chance to hear from the host of that very popular program, Steve Inskeep. He'll be at the Brown Center here in Baltimore in an event hosted by my good friend Nathan Sterner. He'll talk about his work on America's most listened-to radio show and his latest book. It is a terrific read. It's called Jacksonland, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and the Great American Land Grab. It chronicles the rivalry of two strong-willed men in the years after the War of 1812. This morning, Steve Inskeep joins me from the NPR studios in Washington. Morning, Steve. How you doing?
Delighted to be here. Good morning.
Thanks for your time. This is your second book, if I'm counting right. Your first was about the city of Karachi, Pakistan. You talked about the history of that city as well as its recent history. But in this one, you decided to dig further back to the 1830s and Andrew Jackson. What led you to that subject?
Well, it's funny. Those two books are so different, one about a city on the other side of the world and the other about American history, but they both came down in a way to the control of real estate. One was about this rapidly growing megacity, one of those great megacities of the world. Karachi has around 20 million people in it, and it was only a few hundred thousand a few generations ago. And the control of land has been central to that story. When I dug into this episode of American history, it's the early 1800s, it's the expulsion of Indians from the eastern United States, forcing them west across the Mississippi. You find real estate at the heart of that as well. And I did focus on these two characters, Andrew Jackson and John Ross, fighting over land in an emerging democracy, which is what the United States was at the time. And that's really what attracted me to this battle over real estate, is that it was taking place in our system, this recognizable democratic system, which was just taking shape.
Tell us where this real estate is. What is Jackson land?
Okay, Jackson land is my word for land that Andrew Jackson, as a general and then as president of the United States, obtained from Indians for the United States through conquests, through treaties, through legislation as a general, as president, and it is part or all of about seven states. It's an unbelievable expanse. It's the entire state of Florida. It's all of North Georgia. It's a good part of Alabama, Tennessee, North Carolina, Mississippi, West Tennessee. We could go on for quite some time here, a bit of Kentucky even. And it is essentially what we came to think of as the Deep South. Andrew Jackson, in the early 1800s, was creating the Deep South, filling out the South that went on to fight the Civil War, and that remains a vital part of our politics and our culture today.
Talk a little bit about the personality of these two very interesting guys, John Ross and Andrew Jackson. Starting with Jackson, one of the stories you relate is that he was in a duel in 1813 that left a lead ball in his shoulder.
Yes.
He was quite a tough character. He was a slave owner. He's a slave dealer. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff about him that it's quite fascinating.
And the 1813 gunfight that you mentioned was actually the second one that left a lead ball in him for years and years afterward. By the time this guy was inaugurated as president in 1829, he had two bullets in him, which suggests the violence of his life and how tough he was. And neither of those bullets was actually from battle. It was from, you know, civic engagement, so to speak. And he was a guy who had a profound sense of his own honor, who was very combative, who did live in this era when duels were really common. But it was also common that the duel would be resolved at the last moment, that guys would decide to resolve their differences through a duel, but there would be some kind of negotiation, some kind of agreement, and they would both fire in the air, or both fire off to the side, or both not fire at all. Something would be worked out. Jackson, on more than one occasion, resolved to go through with a duel. In 1806, in addition to being shot, he actually killed a man in a duel. The 1813 gunfight that you mentioned was a fight against a guy who had been his own military aide and close friend, who went on to be his friend and aide once again later on in life, Thomas Hart Benton. But he was willing to go after this man with with weaponry, and you get a sense of the violence of what was then the American frontier and the violence of his personality. But he was also a guy who had a keen strategic sense, who seemed to know where he wanted to go in life and kept this driving ambition pushing him forward.
And you talk about how he combined his sense of national security with an urge for personal gain and land development, and his chief rival in this, Cherokee Chief John Ross, you write that he was a century ahead of his time. This is also a formidable character, too.
You know, this is an undiscovered story to me, really. I knew a little bit about Andrew Jackson before I got started in this research. I mean, you see him right there on the $20 bill. You hear about Andrew Jackson. You hear that song, that terrible song from the 1950s about the Battle of New Orleans. You learn something. John Ross was an unknown character to me. He was a son and grandson of Scottish traders and Cherokee women. He was accepted as Cherokee by the Cherokees of the southern, what became the southern United States. And he became the leader, the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation in a time when they were fighting to preserve their land and their rights within this rapidly expanding United States in the early 1800s. And instead of doing that by going to war, as many Indian tribes and nations did, John Ross decided to fight within the American system, which he accepted. And so he was arguing for the rights, in effect, of a racial minority within the wider United States, and setting patterns that would later be followed, perhaps unknowingly, but followed by civil rights leaders more than a century later on some of the same ground in the South. And John Ross did things that civil rights leaders later did, like gaining white allies, primarily through religious connections and religious communities, battling in Congress, battling in the media, getting the word out by starting their own newspaper. When everything else failed, going to the court, suing in the Supreme Court, and actually winning a case, although it was effectively disregarded. The Cherokees won a famous case in 1832. And when all else failed, when even the courts failed because the ruling did not have the effect that it should have had, the Cherokees tried a form of civil disobedience. Soldiers came to take them off of their land, and they didn't go anywhere. They refused to go anywhere. It's a really dramatic story. We learn a phrase of it. We learn something about the Trail of Tears, which is what it's called when the Cherokees were finally forced to move west to what is now Oklahoma. But I think we miss so much because the Cherokees were more than mere victims in this story. They were actors in this story who fought in their own defense. And even if they lost, it's a very dramatic record. They held out for a very long time.
Talk to somebody who read your book who is actually a descendant of John Ridge, one of the Cherokee figures you write about in the book. Her perspective is that of a Cherokee, and she said that this notion of Indian removal, removing them from the Southeast and displacing them to the West, is equivalent to genocide. Would you concur with that assessment?
I would argue a little bit with that term. I don't have a problem with people using it about different parts of the experience of European colonizers and counting the native peoples of North and South America. Just think of all the countless people who are estimated to have died from disease, from wars, from slavery, from other issues over the years. But the specific policy that came to be known by the awful phrase Indian removal seems to me better described by other words. The intent was not to exterminate a people, to destroy a people. It was, in effect, to segregate them, which is a bad enough term, an awful enough term to use. The idea here was that Indians were inferior, incapable of being properly civilized according to the white people of the time, even though Cherokees and others actually were taking on white customs and white clothes and education and modern agriculture and so forth. They were civilizing by the standards of the time. It was presumed that they couldn't do it and that they should be shoved off to the side, off into the distance where they could live their separate and segregated lives. It is a monumental atrocity. I'm not sure that genocide is exactly the word for it, though.
And speaking of civilized, when we look at the current political discourse, a discourse that Andrew Jackson still has some sort of influence and presence in, the annual Jefferson-Jackson dinner in Iowa, which took place a couple of weeks ago. The insiders refer to it as the Jeff Jack. There are some people sort of walking away from that association with Andrew Jackson, or Thomas Jefferson for that matter, principally because of the fact that they owned slaves. Do you think Jackson's influence is destined to wane even further as the years progress?
Well, it's been a huge news year for Jackson, hasn't it? There's been a campaign to put a woman on the 20 in place of Andrew Jackson. The Treasury Department hasn't quite done that. They're changing the $10 bill with Alexander Hamilton instead, at least for now. There has been this controversy over the Jefferson-Jackson dinners, and I think that it all reminds us how central Andrew Jackson's story and different parts of that story is to the American story, for better or for worse. This was an age when the United States was becoming more small-d democratic. It's been a republic from its founding. It was not all that democratic at the beginning. There was a small group of elites who were making a lot of the decisions. There weren't all that many people who voted, and the Constitution was set up to curb the power of majority rule. Andrew Jackson arrived and was a great proponent of the idea of majority rule. Now, he had a very specific idea of majority rule, that it should be the majority that supported him, and whatever he wanted was what he believed the majority wanted. It was a self-serving idea of majority rule. But he talked a lot about democracy, at least for white men. And it was a time when the media were exploding in number. The number of newspapers was increasing across the country. Political participation was going up. Percentage of people who voted was going up. Mass political events and rallies were going up. It became, before long, this era of great long speeches like the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which went on for hours. It was a democratizing period that Andrew Jackson, with all of his monumental flaws, became a symbol of. And those Jefferson-Jackson dinners just emphasize how that has lasted to this day. Now, it is a fair question. Do you still want to honor a man who was a slave owner and who was the greatest single architect of Indian removal and who did many other things that we would consider awful by our standards? But you kind of can't get away from his legacy. The best thing to know about Jackson, I think, is that his critics today are using the democratic process, using the media, using their right to speak out, using arguments, using creative political techniques. They are using techniques that Andrew Jackson's political party pioneered generations ago to criticize and get a fuller picture of the proper reputation of Andrew Jackson.
On 81, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest is Steve Inskeep, the host of Morning Edition. Steve, you have more listeners in the morning than anybody else, and the media in particular has been under a good bit of scrutiny in these last few weeks. Just this morning, you all were reporting about the Carson campaign. Dr. Ben Carson from Baltimore, of course, saying, yeah, you know, complaining that he's being scrutinized in a way that other people aren't. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I don't think that he's being scrutinized in a way that other people aren't. That doesn't mean that all the scrutiny has been fair or unfair, but the fact is that when a candidate goes up in the polls, he or she will get additional scrutiny. This is inevitable. There is something a little bit extreme, a little bit unbalanced about it. People pay no attention to a presidential candidate when he's at 5%, and then it gets up to 15% or 20%, and suddenly every little bit of his or her life will be thrown out there for scrutiny. So it's excessive, and we're excessive sometimes in ignoring people, and then excessive in paying attention to little things about them. But with those excesses acknowledged, I think you would rather have a careful look at the people who want to be president than to not have a careful look at the people who want to be president. And in the case of someone like Ben Carson, there is a record there, and there are statements that he's made, and there's a book that he's written, and there are things that you can explore.
Indeed.
And so simply asking questions about that seems to me to be perfectly fair and perfectly democratic, although it is fair of him to argue that someone has not told the truth about him. So make your case. Get the truth out there if you can.
Steve Inskeep, you can can hear him every morning on Morning Edition here on 88.1. You can see him tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Brown Center at the Maryland Institute College of Art. Steve will talk about his book, Jacksonland. He'll sign copies, and he'll be in conversation with our very own Nathan Sterner. We've got all the details on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Steve Inskeep, thanks so much. We'll see you tomorrow night.
Honored to be here. Thank you.
Speaking of Nathan Sterner, coming up after a break for news, he will be enlightening us as to the status of the deer population in Maryland. Nathan, we are looking forward to that. First, we have our weekly theater review from Maryland Morning Theater critic, J. Wynn Russick. Stick around.